So between 1983 and 1998, the Chicago Cubs had a few good years. I'm thinking in particular about 1984 and 1989. But throughout some of those other lean years, two things Chicago Cubs fans could always count on: a great experience at Wrigley Field and one of the best broadcast teams in baseball with Harry Carey and Steve Stone.
I don't know what the big deal about Cracker Jack is. Did you ever go and buy a pack of Cracker Jack thinking you'd get a prize and find no prize in the box? That might not sound important to some people, but when you're a little kid, especially from humble origin, and they cheat you out of a prize, it's hard to think in laudatory terms of the product.
I take it there was an occasional box of Cracker Jacks that found no prizes for the little Harry Carey many years ago.
You got that right. And boy, when a box of Cracker Jack to me meant a lot of money.
Man, I miss hearing him calling Chicago Cubs games, and I miss those two in the booth. Steve Stone won 107 games in his big league career. He was an All-Star and a Cy Young Award winner. He began his broadcast career shortly after retirement, first with Al Michaels and Company on Monday Night Baseball, and then from 1983 to 2004 with the Chicago Cubs, 15 of those years with Harry Carey. And since 2005, he's been a member of the Chicago White Sox broadcast booth. Steve Stone is my guest on this episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.
This is Harry Carey with Jack Buck and Jerry Gross from the beautiful new Bush Memorial Stadium. And boy, I tell you, this is some sight.
The crowd still is coming in. The bleacher area in center field almost filled. And the indication is that it's going to be a fine Friday night crowd here at the Polo Grounds.
We're underway in the first of a twi-night doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
The F&M Schaefer Brewing Company, very happy to be pouring it to you from Ebbets Field tonight. And this should be a humdinger.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Al Helfer with Art Gleason bringing you Mutual's Game of the Day from sunny Shy Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Just the start of things. Don't pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold Schaefer or two throughout the evening.
Steve Stone, welcome to Lost Ballparks. How are you?
Just delightful.
Great. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, that's terrific.
You grew up in Cleveland, actually, not far from where I did. So I'm guessing the first game, like it was for me, the first one you ever attended as a kid, was it up there on Lake Erie at Cleveland's Municipal Stadium? Is that right?
That is right. And I think what was shocking to me and left an indelible impression was the expanse of green that I saw, because in the place I grew up, it was a two-family home. There wasn't much of any yard. And then I remember my father, who changed records in a jukebox, was a serviceman in the Teamsters Union. He could only afford upper deck seats. So we walked up this runway, which scared me to death because I was afraid of heights. And then we came to the portal, and I looked out and saw this massive field. And it was the greenest thing I had ever seen. It was startling. And I remember just sitting up there thinking I was going to fall out of the upper deck, but never having experienced anything that looked this inviting, this lovely. And I could only imagine one day I would be able to play on that. Of course, that came true.
In college, Steve, at Kent State University, of course, you played baseball. But this right, you played on the volleyball team?
They were fraternity sports, and we had exceptional athletics as far as interfraternity was concerned. I played on my fraternity football, basketball. We didn't have a tennis team, but a volleyball team, a bowling team.
Right, right.
And it was a whole lot of fun. But I was a city champion in singles and doubles in tennis, and actually was a much better tennis player at the time than a baseball player. And I remember my father, at the age of 12, after I had won the city championship in both, he pulled me aside and said, look, if you want to, you can be a jack of all trades. You can play tennis. You can play baseball. You can do whatever it is you want. But if you're thinking about one seriously, you can't be a tennis player and a pitcher because it'll be too much strain on your arm, which was young and developing at the time. And he was exactly right. So I liked tennis, was very good at it, but I loved baseball. So I put down the tennis racket, never to pick it up for 13 years, and then concentrated on baseball. And he was a man that was very wise in his advice, and it worked out pretty well.
You made your major league debut on April 8th, 1971 at San Diego Stadium, which would, of course, later become known as Jack Murphy Stadium.
San Diego Stadium, 330 feet down the line, 370 in the power alleys, 420 to straightaway center, and a 17-foot wall completely around the playing field.
There had to be a point as you, Steve, run out to the mound that first inning, playing for the San Francisco Giants with the palm trees waving in the distance, and you take a second and survey the players behind you and the pitchers who were in the dugout and the bullpen, and you're surrounded by legends.
Well, you painted an excellent picture of exactly what happened. I remember on that mound, bouncing the ball up and down in my hand and looking out to center field and seeing Willie Mays. I mean, I was this short right-handed starter from Cleveland, and there's Willie Mays ready to chase down my mistakes. And we had Willie McCovey at first base, and the number one starter on that team was Juan Marichal, and the number two starter was Gaylord Perry. So those were four Hall of Famers on my first team. And it was pretty heady stuff. We also had Bobby Bonds in right field, who was a member of the 30-30 club five different times. So we had enormous talent. We wound up winning our division. But I remember that first game because there was a guy by the name of Bill Campbell who got the first hit. It was a 3-2 slider. I didn't throw many sliders at the time. I have no idea why I played inventive pitch with my first hitter. But he singled to center field. And then on a 2-0 count, Larry Stahl, who had no power whatsoever, hit a home run. And with two hitters in my major league career, I had an infinite ERA. So I figured things would get better after that. But I remember getting a no decision in not only that start, but the next two. And then inviting my parents to come and see me pitch in Pittsburgh against a very good Pirate team that wound up winning their division that year. In fact, my Giants and those Pirates wound up playing as you went to the World Series. But that night in Pittsburgh, my first major league win with a five-hit shutout with my parents in the stands, having made the trip from Cleveland, Ohio to Pittsburgh, a little over a two-hour drive.
Yeah.
And it was really thrilling.
Yeah, you get your first win at Three River Stadium, and then you play your home games, of course, at Candlestick Park.
NBC Sports presents baseball's game of the week today from Candlestick Park. Tony, here is Steve Stowe, and he is quite a young pitcher for the Giants.
It was a terrible place to play, but if you could hit the ball to right center field, you could hit a lot of home runs there. The wind was startling. They hadn't enclosed it yet for the benefit of the 49ers, and I'm not sure why they enclosed it, because when football season started, that was actually the summer in the Bay Area. But during the early spring and even the summer, I mean, it was just horrible. The wind, and there was a wonderful shot of Stu Miller getting actually blown off the mound there. But I remember having to lean over to make sure that the wind didn't blow you off the mound, and you can commit a balk that way. But it was freezing. It was damp. It was windy. It was just a horrible place. And the Giants called that home for a lot of years until they moved into their new facilities.
By 73, you're pitching with the White Sox. And so what do you think of Comiskey Park, your first time pitching there? Was there anything about the bullpen or the pitching mound or the grounds crew or the clubhouse that was remarkable to you? Obviously, there's so much history at that ballpark.
Well, there was certainly, and it was old, but it was a great place to pitch because the fences were way out there. It was difficult to hit home runs. The facilities weren't great. The ballpark I really liked. And there were a lot of people that learned their baseball going to Comiskey Park, just as I had learned my baseball going to Municipal Stadium in Cleveland. It was one of those things that was probably a little better for the fan as far as sight lines and places to watch the game and things to do there than it was for the players and the facilities. But we didn't think about those great facilities for working out or all those other things. That era of baseball hadn't happened yet. And I remember just going there in 73, and one of my teammates was Dick Allen, who turned out to be a really nice man, and we got along very well. Yeah, it was an interesting year. Dick had won the MVP in 72. We thought we had a good chance to win it in 73. It didn't work out that way. But then I was traded to the Cubs the next year in the Ron Santo deal. I was the only major leaguer. It was me and three minor leaguers who went to the Cubs for Ron Santo.
That trade, in fact, brought you to Wrigley Field. And so now you have the privilege of playing at two very historic ballparks, Comiskey and Wrigley.
And the one thing that I really take pride in, because it's never been done before and I don't think it's ever going to be done again, was I remained the only player who not only has played for both teams, because there's been a lot of players to do that, played for both teams, but also did radio and television for both teams.
Right.
Nobody else has done that. And so it's with pride that I say that I've had the opportunity to do that. I've always gotten along very well with the fandoms of both teams. Chicago remains a great place to either, one, be a baseball player, or two, then be in the Chicago sports media. So I've kind of made a home here since 1973, with the exception of the 4 years that I wound up in Baltimore. But I consider Chicago my home away from home. I've always enjoyed it.
By 79, you're part of the Orioles pitching staff. Did you like pitching at Memorial Stadium? What made that place special for you?
I loved pitching there for a couple of different reasons. Number one, we had a very good baseball team. Number two, it was a difficult place to hit the ball out of. For some reason, even though the fences weren't all that far, it was 309 down each line. And the power alleys were fairly substantial, but it was a dead ballpark. You had to really hit it to get it out. However, I defied that many times because being a high fastball pitcher, I gave up a lot of home runs. Historically, Dwayne Kuiper's only home run. I used to spread joy around the league. Sandy Alomar, I think, had 13. I gave up one to him. So again, being a high fastball pitcher, you gave up a lot of fly balls. And Baltimore was perfect for me. I didn't realize when I signed that free agent contract just how good the city of Baltimore and the Baltimore Orioles would be for me. But most of the great things that I accomplished in baseball were accomplished in that Baltimore uniform. I learned how to play on a winning team. I learned how to play for a manager who was a Hall of Famer in Earl Weaver.
Yeah.
I learned how to play with a great pitching staff. We had 5 Cy Young Awards on that staff. We had 3-time Cy Young Award winner Jim Palmer. We had Mike Flanagan, who won it in 1979. I won it in 1980. The ball club was wonderful, and they showed me a lot about how to be with a winning team and how to play winning baseball. The Orioles were a collection of guys who epitomized the phrase that the whole was better than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
Because on the surface, we didn't have the talent of the New York Yankees, but collectively, this team could out-execute and eventually beat a whole lot of ball clubs that appeared on the surface to be better.
And 1980 was such a magical year for you, Steve. You led baseball with 25 wins, including during that time a 14-game winning streak, and you go on, as you said, to win the Cy Young. That year, the All-Star Game was played at Dodger Stadium.
Shadows of a soft summer day reaching across Dodger Stadium. We're expecting a capacity crowd of more than 55,000 for the ball game. And hello again, everybody. I'm Keith Jackson, and we are delighted to be able to bring you tonight's All-Star Game from Dodger Stadium.
Probably just like everyone who grows up loving this game, I'm sure you had a dream to not only play in an All-Star Game, but to hear your name, right?
That was actually one of the things that I thought about. And I thought about that for a long time. And there were a couple of things that I still remember from my career, pivotal moments that have been etched on my subconscious at the time. One of the things was, as a minor leaguer in the San Francisco organization, driving by Candlestick Park and looking at it and saying, I'm going to pitch there in the not too distant future. And another thing was wanting to hear my name announced by the public address announcer as I was warming up in the bullpen. 1980, I had the ability to do that.
Warming up in the bullpen for the Baltimore Orioles, a 12-game winner already this year, Steve Stone.
Earl, because we had won the American League the year before and played in the World Series, Earl was the manager for that All-Star game. It worked out perfectly because this was my 5th day, the day that the All-Star game was played. So it was a natural progression, and Earl Weaver named me as a starter. And in those days, if you were going along okay, you got to pitch 3 innings. And it was magical. I had my parents to that game also. I arranged for them to fly out to Los Angeles to see that game. They were sitting somewhere above the dugout. And as I found out later, because I didn't know at the time, I threw 3 perfect innings.
I must tell you, Keith, without meaning to interrupt you, that Steve Stone, as he goes off there, the first American League pitcher since Denny McLain to pitch 3 hitless innings for the American League.
It hasn't been done since, and it'll never be done again because nobody's going to let the starting pitcher go 3 innings. Nobody wants their pitcher to go 3 innings in the All-Star game. So that whole year was magical from start to finish. And I think back to various times and looking for my folks after I had struck out Bob Welsh. And the interesting part about facing Bob Welsh as the 9th out of 9 in a row was that he and I remain the only 2 pitchers since 1980, so the last going on 43 years now, the only 2 pitchers to have won 25 or more games. It's a difficult thing because you have to remain consistent. You have to remain uninjured, which the way the guys are throwing today, as hard as they are with the depth of the sliders they're using, it is a difficult thing to pick up all the starts you have to pick up. That year I started 37 times. I don't think there's going to be guys start 37 games again.
By the way, I think this is everything you need to know about Steve Stone, about your character, about your gratefulness. But prior to the game, I believe you wrote 31 thank you notes to your teammates and coaches for helping you get there, which I thought was a really cool gesture.
Well, they did. I mean, without those guys, I would have had probably a decent year, but nothing close to what happened. And so, yes, I felt appreciative to them. And I did that. I actually hadn't thought about that in quite some time. Thank you for bringing it up. But I felt that they were primarily responsible for not only the All-Star game, because that was only half the season, but what happened down the road. I mean, I won 12 games before the All-Star game. I won 13 after. And it was those guys on that team that refused to lose that actually got me to the pinnacle. And I remember going over to Baltimore and not an everyday player, a guy by the name of Terry Crowley, who was a pinch hitter. After I got taken out of a game by Earl Weaver, who for some reason, even though I was a 9-year veteran of the major leagues, he didn't want me to go deep into games. He didn't trust me because I hadn't done it for him. And I was just steaming. And Terry Crowley came into the shower and said, grab a towel and come out here. Because I was only there, I think it was 5 starts into the season.
Yeah.
And he said, look. He said, don't let that little guy bother you. He said, he's going to do that to everybody who's just getting here. But understand something with this Oriole group. You have to be a winning player or you wouldn't be here, because that's what this team is. This is a group of professional winners. And remember one thing, we don't score early and we don't score often. But if you hold us close, keep us in the game, that other team is going to make a mistake in the 7th, 8th, and 9th inning. And we're going to bury them with that.
Wow.
He said, you're going to win more games than you ever dreamt you could win if you keep us close. And as long as you're here in Baltimore, you're here to do a job. We know what the job is. And you just go along with the program and things will work out really well. And there was another guy came up to me. It was Mark Belanger. It was in kind of the twilight of his playing career.
Shortstop for the Orioles, yeah.
Yeah, we had given up 47 runs or something along those lines to Milwaukee in a series in April. I mean, it was just a pounding. And I was walking up the stairs with him, because you walked up these long stairs to get into the locker room. And I had my head down, almost shaking my head. And he goes, what's wrong with you? I said, what's wrong? 47 runs, man. That's a lot of runs. He goes, you worried about that? I said, yeah, it was a beating. He said, let me tell you something. And he took his glove and he hit me on the chest by the Baltimore, because, you know, you wore the Orioles at home, you wore the Baltimore on the road.
Oh, right, yeah.
And he said, as long as you're wearing that uniform, he said, we come back here twice. We come back at the end of June. We come back the beginning of September. Starting June 1st, nobody hits our pitching. Nobody. He said, we come back here twice. They're not going to hit our pitching and we're going to kill theirs. Just remember that. And these were two guys, neither stars at that point, both explaining to me what being with the Baltimore Orioles and a winning team was like. And I learned how to do that. I learned how to be with a winning club. And it was those players who had this belief that it didn't matter who we were playing, we were going to win that night. That's what made the Orioles of that era special.
After you retired, Steve, I think in 82, you spent some time in the ABC Monday Night Baseball booth with the likes of Al Michaels and Drysdale and Uecker and Cosell. And then you joined Harry Carey in the booth, the Cubs booth, in 83, quickly becoming, I think, one of the most beloved broadcast teams in baseball history.
It's a beautiful day for baseball. Hello again, everybody. This is Harry Carey with Steve Stone from Wrigley Field.
For someone who's never been inside the broadcast booth at Wrigley, can you paint a picture for us of what it was like when you joined Harry in 1983?
Well, Harry was an interesting character, as you know, has been chronicled many times. He had a great love for the game of baseball till 1987, and I think that was 42 years for Harry. He had never missed an inning, not an inning.
Wow.
I mean, the man never went to the bathroom. And I said, how can you possibly do this? I'm a lot younger than you, and I have to go to the bathroom during the game. And he goes, I've trained myself. I said, train yourself? How can you train yourself? In any event, he was interesting to be with. He really helped me understand how to be a local broadcaster. The chronology was, I stayed unemployed. When I announced my retirement, I stayed unemployed for 4 days. And then I got a job with ABC. I went to the Monday Night Baseball booth, and the first guys I worked with were Al Michaels and Don Drysdale. And the next week, I worked with Al Michaels and Howard Cosell. But I enjoyed the idea of a local broadcast because I wanted to root for the team I was broadcasting. If you're a national broadcaster, you can't root for either side. But I learned a lot from those guys on Monday Night Baseball. And the second year, when I broadcast Monday Night Baseball, I also was in my first year with the Cubs, realizing then that my future was probably with the Cubs, and I stayed with them. But broadcasting with Harry was an experience that I wish more people had an opportunity to do, because you never knew what was going to happen. You never knew what he was going to say. You had to be prepared for everything. There were times when, when I would prepare for the pitching matchup on that given day in the opening, and then Harry would start out and give the pitching matchup. So you had to adjust always on the fly, again, never knowing what he was going to say. And I was the straight man, and I was the guy that had to bring the game back to the field at any one given time.
Yeah.
Let Harry go where he went, eventually getting him back.
You're not falling asleep, are you?
I think some are.
I think it was a great partnership for the 15 years we were together. And like everything, it's almost like a marriage. In fact, when you're broadcasting with somebody, you're traveling on the road with them, you're spending 3, in those days, sometimes 4 hours live in the booth. You're actually spending more time with that person than their wives are. And so Harry and I had our moments where we didn't get along real well, but for the most part, he realized that our team was a good team. I was offered a couple of different jobs. I was offered the number one radio job with WGN, and I thought about it for a bit. And then I went to Dan Fabian, who was in charge of WGN radio, and I said, look, I kind of like this Harry and Steve thing. I want to play it, see where it goes for a while, because if I go on the radio as the number one guy, I'm going to be crisscrossed to Harry. He's going to come over, do the middle three on radio. I'm going to do the middle three on television. And Harry and I are not going to broadcast together. So I stayed there. I was offered a job with the Yankees. I was offered a job with the Angels. And I just felt that Chicago was a city like the city I grew up in, like Cleveland. It's a blue-collar city with blue-collar fans for the most part.
Yeah.
I felt really comfortable here, and I love the association with Harry. It was magical at times.
There's a long drive, way back, might be, Cubs win! Holy cow, is that a happy team? The Cubs have won 6 in a row.
At the end of the day, it was still baseball. We did all day games for many years, as you know, until, well, it was supposed to be 8-8-88. It turned out to be 8-9-88 because of the rainout. But those were some thrilling times. I get to broadcast with Ronald Reagan when he was president.
Harry Carey and Steve Sohn back at Wrigley Field. And it's with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce to you the president of the United States, taking over the role of a play-by-play announcer, Ronald Reagan, at the mic.
Well, Harry, thank you very much. You know, in a few months, I'm going to be out of work, and I thought I might as well audition.
Well, I'm afraid that you got this job anytime you want it.
I mean, how many guys get to do some analysis with the President of the United States doing play-by-play? I mean, that doesn't happen very much, but it happened because of the Cubs, because of WGN, because of the great baseball world that is Wrigley Field. I mean, it was one of those times that you look back on, you shake your head, you wonder if it was really you who did that.
Yeah, and by the way, the booth was a blue-collar booth, and I'm talking about just the layout, the logistics, because summer days, the wind would blow, I think, from the southwest, so you would get no breeze in the booth. And then when it got cold and windy, the wind would come off of Lake Michigan and it would come from the east, and I think it would just hit you right in the face like a freight truck.
Yeah, it was really the worst of all worlds as far as the booth was concerned. And then I remember they wouldn't tell me that President Reagan was coming up to the booth. Harry knew because he wore a suit jacket that day. I was in this red red sweater with a 9 the size of a satellite dish. So I was sitting there, and all I could hear from Arnie Harris, who was our producer-director for many years, was, just keep talking. I'm wondering, you know, the opening is going way long, and then Harry and I were looking at the camera, which was across the field on the first base side, and Arnie kept saying, keep on going, and I couldn't understand what was going on, and all of a sudden, I have this tail that was in my lap, and I thought a squirrel had come down from the rafters, which was not beyond happening there, because the booth was a billion years old and not very well kept, but I thought, oh my, this is a squirrel. And then I reached down and there was this wet nose. And now I realized that it was a dog. It wasn't a squirrel. And then I had a feeling what was going to happen, because having been in the locker room during the World Series and having President Carter come in, I remember they brought in explosive sniffing dogs. And that preceded the president in. So I figured, that's why there's tarps up the walkway that we got to the booth and everything else. It's because President Reagan was going to be there. But I didn't know that until I thought a squirrel had broken into the booth.
Speaking of broadcast booths and your inaugural season, I want to talk just real quickly about a couple of the other stadium's booths. When the Cubs were in Cincinnati to take on the Reds at Riverfront Stadium, that booth, I believe, had a precarious descent. And you essentially saved Harry's life. Do you remember that in 83?
I remember just about everything. Yes, the synapses are still firing. But yeah, I told Harry that you have to be really careful because the steps going up were very steep. And Harry would always change over. After the third inning, he would go over to radio, and then he would do three innings there, come back. And I said, you know, just be really careful. So as he's coming back, I just remember all of a sudden I hear this, whoa, and I look, and there's Harry. His foot is stuck. He's fallen down the stairs, but his foot was caught in one of the stairs. And I don't know how he didn't break his ankle, but I had to help him up as he was... as he was kind of almost impaled in this particular area. So that was pretty interesting, I thought, helping Harry get there and still getting back to do the start of the inning. But there were other times when we go on these trips, and I remember on this one trip, the camera that we would speak into on that changeover, it was down at the end of the booth, so you had to look out toward left field. And that was the place we were before. And in this new place, it was Cincinnati, it was Pittsburgh, I believe. In this new place, the camera was straight up on the stairs, and you had to look up. So Harry kind of lost track of where we were, and the camera was down toward left field, and he was looking up at the second tier of the booth.
So you've got like a side profile of Harry's face.
All we're getting is Harry's ear with the IFB in it. And Arnie Harris says, where's he looking? I said, he's looking straight up. He goes, why is he looking there? I said, I think he thinks we're still in St. Louis. And so he said, well, can you get him to turn around? I said, I don't know, but why don't you cut away? So he cuts away. But before then, I tried to take the IFB and gently ease it so it was like coming out of his ear. But he didn't notice that because I don't know if he had any feelings in his ears. But he didn't notice that. And all you could see on the shot was the IFB flying out of Harry's ear. Then another time we're in St. Louis and we come back to do the seventh inning. And Harry is sitting on the cough button. So he's looking at the camera, sitting on the cough button, and he's mouthing the words. But because he's on the cough button, which cuts off your mic, nobody can hear him. And Arnie Harris said to me, what's he doing? I said, he's sitting on the cough button. He goes, can you get him off the cough button? I said, yeah, you're going to have to cut away again. So he cuts away and I grab Harry, pull him off the cough button, take the cough button away. There was that. And then when he was talking into the light we had lights in the booth because it was very difficult to see. And he comes back again for the seventh inning.
Oh, like the gooseneck lights?
Yeah, he picks up the gooseneck light, talking into it. And Ernie go, what's he doing? I said, he's talking into the lamp. He said, well, can you get him the mic? I said, yeah, cut away again. I'll get him the mic. So this was a continuing saga. And it was was interesting. It was part of the charm that was our partnership. But again, you never knew what was going to happen, and you had to be ready for everything.
Meanwhile, when you walked into the booth at the vet in Philadelphia, you might want to make sure your life insurance policy was up to date, because was that not the booth where the ledge was so low, like you could fall right out, descend to your death?
We had a wooden platform that served as the place where the camera would sit, the home plate camera, to get the shots that would track the baseball. And so it was probably a 4-inch wooden platform. And Harry always, you know, he would always refer to me as you short guys. And I would say to him, well, you're not exactly Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you know. That was the time before Harry realized when he was looking at the on camera that I was 2.5 inches taller than he was. But that didn't matter to him because there was Harry Land and there was reality.
Yeah.
But this time he was going to open on that platform and then put the mic down to me because he insisted on having only one microphone. He wanted the IFB and he wanted the microphone on the on cameras because when he wanted to talk, he would just take the mic away regardless of where I was. That was one of the dynamics of the partnership. But on this time, he came by, oh, this is a terrible idea, he said. Then he came down and he stumbled and he hit me in the chest with an elbow and almost knocked me out of the booth. I mean, literally, I was fighting for my life and trying to get back in the booth because if I fall out of that booth, I'm going into the upper deck.
Yes, and it's a 30-foot drop.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been a really good thing. So eventually, I fought my way back, just snapped up as Harry was ready to hand me the mic, put the mic over to me. And there I was sweating because I saw my life flashing before my eyes and had to then do the on camera. So again, you know, being ready for everything, that was part of the plan.
Yeah, listen, Steve, I want to end with this story. It's a great section of your book, Where's Harry? Steve Stone remembers his years with Harry Carey. June 1993, I think, at Wrigley Field, and Harry's making his way back to the broadcasting booth from the bathroom when he gets stuck. shall we say?
The thing was, we had an AD in the booth named Mandy Cohen, who went on to be a producer, and she's a wonderful and very smart woman, and she got her start in the WGN booth, which a lot of people did. And one of the things that she did was every day Harry would say, "Mandy, get me a root beer." And every day Mandy would say, "Harry, we don't have root beer." And every day he said, "Well, bring me something." So anyway, this went on for like 3 weeks, a month. And finally, I said to Mandy, "Look, when he asks for a root beer, you and I both know there's no root beer, but Harry has no taste buds anyway. So go get him a Diet Pepsi, and he'll think it's root beer, and everything will be fine." So on this one day, Harry has walked back from the bathroom, and he said, "Mandy, get me a root beer." She leaves the booth. I'm sitting there writing up my scorecard, and all of a sudden, I hear this scream, and there's Harry, and he's standing up. And I'm looking over, and he's yanking at his pants, telling me that he's stuck. Apparently, he had gotten little Harry stuck in his zipper, which will happen on occasion, as we all know. And he's just frantically pulling at it and hopping up and down. And you could see into the broadcast booth at that point. It was the new broadcast booth. You could see into it from both sides. And I said, "Harry, you got to sit down." He says, "No, you don't understand. I'm stuck." I said, "No, I understand, but you can't be hopping up and down like you're hopping up and down." I said, "Just sit down." So he sits down. And meantime, you know, when it happens to somebody else and you're sitting next to them, you're laughing uncontrollably because it's very funny if it's not you.
Right.
And eventually, I mean, Harry's just fighting with this thing. And eventually I see the door opening and here comes Mandy with her tray of drinks. And I said to him, "Harry, you better yank that little sucker out of there because Mandy's coming back in the booth." And I hear this Herculean scream, this "Ew!" And I look down and he is sweating like a wildebeest and face is bright red like a tomato. And he crossed his legs. He probably was bleeding for about three innings. And Mandy goes, "Hey, what's going on?" I said, "Everything is just fine." And that was just one. That was just another day in the Cubs booth with Harry Carey.
14 years pitching in the big leagues with the Giants, White Sox, Cubs, and Orioles. You won 107 games, Steve, an All-Star, a Cy Young Award winner. Longtime broadcaster for the Cubs, working alongside Hall of Famer Harry Carey. And since 2005, you've been in the booth calling games for the White Sox. I mean, look, we could spend a whole other episode just talking about your time with longtime White Sox broadcaster Ken Harrelson with the Hawk. But I'm so grateful for your time today sharing these stories. It's been so much fun traveling back in time with you.
Well, thank you, and take care, and you did your homework on this one, so I applaud you. It's good journalism.
That guy has the best stories. I was thinking about this as we were talking, how much I would have loved to have spent a few days in the booth with him and Harry Carey. Can you imagine? With some of those conversations in between innings? Steve's book is definitely worth checking out. I've got a link to it in the notes of this episode. Many thanks to Steve and to the Chicago White Sox for helping make this interview happen. The Lost Ballparks podcast is produced by Mike Dunn, Xavier Guerra, Kyle Schmidt, Manny Zavlakis, Briggs Buckingham, Alex Kemp, Ryan Beard, Mike Lipinski, and John Carter. Thank you again for listening. I really appreciate it. And for those of you who have sent in messages, thank you for that, too. If you get a chance and you're able to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, that would be great. And I really appreciate all who have done that already. Looking forward to being back with you again for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.